It's 12:37. The front that brought some showers and thunderstorms to the region yesterday and this morning is tracking to the east by this evening and tomorrow. High pressure will build in from the north, bringing the region quieter weather with cooler temperatures and less humid air. We'll see another spell of heat and humidity, however, this weekend. Highs today will range from the 70s in Wisconsin to the low 90s in southern Illinois and Missouri. Lows overnight will be in the 50s and 60s over much of the region, but warmer along the Ohio River Valley. The forecast for east central Illinois this afternoon, partly sunny, not as warm. Look for a high in the low 80s. The wind out of the northeast at 10 to 15 miles per hour tonight, partly cloudy and cooler with a low of 57. The wind will be from the east at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, seasonably cool, the high 80. The wind from the east at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low of 65 and a light east wind. Friday, mostly sunny with a high of 85. The wind light and from the southeast. Friday night and Saturday, partly cloudy and much warmer with a low Friday night around 70 and the high Saturday around 90 with afternoon heat index readings ranging from 97 to 102. Saturday night, mostly clear with a low in the mid-70s. Sunday, mostly sunny with a high in the low 90s and afternoon heat index readings approaching 110 degrees. At noon central time across Illinois and Indiana, temperatures were in the low 70s to mid 80s. Most locations reported some sunshine. At Rockford, 75, O'Hare, 73. In Bloomington, 77 degrees. It was 80 at Mattoon, 82 at Carbondale. At South Bend, 75. Lafayette reported 78 degrees. 82 at Indianapolis, 81 at Terre Haute, 86 at Evansville. Willard Airport reported 77 degrees at the top of the hour, the sky cloudy. The dew point, 64. The relative humidity, 64%. The wind out of the east at 10. The barometric pressure, 30.06 and rising. And at 12:39, 78 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. The Rhode Island city of Central Falls is sliding closer to bankruptcy. The state will not give the cash-strapped city money to pay its bills for the fiscal year that just ended, and the city is entering the new fiscal year nearly $5 million in the hole. Catherine Welch of NPR member station WNRI has more.
Pat Shalasta's barbershop sits on one of the few streets in Central Falls that actually has business traffic. His father opened the barbershop in 1947, and Shalasta's been running it for the last 50 years. Cooling off near the air conditioner, he remembers when bakeries and specialty shops lined the street before pawn shops and nail salons took over.
When I was born in this city up until a few years ago, if you lived here, you did not have to go out of the city to do any type of shopping.
Back then, Central Falls was quiet. Everyone knew each other, and few locked their doors. But the city's fallen on hard times, and the average household income is now just $22,000. Seeking to turn things around, Shalasta won a seat on the Central Falls City Council. But 6 months after the mayor turned the keys over to a receiver last year, City Council was banned from meeting or doing business.
All we can do is keep our fingers crossed, hope the council gets back to work, and the receiver lets the council run the city.
So how did Central Falls get this way? There were some questionable transactions between politicians and their friends. And when the state-appointed receiver combed the city's books, he found no evidence of any financial planning in the last several years. So to raise cash, he hiked property taxes by a whopping 19%, which few could afford. In October, Central Falls is expected to run out of money to pay its police and fire pension obligations. Retired firefighter Howard Baskins depends on those checks.
My rent's $1,000 a month. It's more than half of my pension. When I don't pay, what do I do? Where do I go?
Central Falls hasn't fully funded the pension in 6 years. Now the city's 19,000 residents owe an astonishing $80 million. The city's receiver, Robert Flanders, is negotiating with workers, unions, and pensioners. In a quiet conference room in the state capitol, Flanders says pensions now account for half of the city's budget deficit.
With a $17 million budget and a $5 million almost budget shortfall or structural deficit, we don't have any options except to do whatever we can to raise revenue and whatever we can to cut expenses.
But Howard Baskins doesn't want to talk about concessions. While digging through his files for his pension papers, he gets upset just thinking about it.
We paid whatever they said. We didn't question it. We didn't misappropriate our funds. They did it to themselves. But why should we suffer? We held a bar end of the bargain.
Earlier this year, Flanders asked Rhode Island for a cash infusion, which it refused. That sparked the bond rating agency Moody's to downgrade Central Falls to near the bottom of junk bond status and teetering on the edge of bankruptcy.
Automatically, the publicity will create a dark cloud over the entire state.
That's University of Rhode Island business professor Edward Mazey, who says a Central Falls bankruptcy will hurt the entire state's economy.
Which means that, you know, over time, we will be paying more for money we borrow, and some of our bonds may actually become junk bonds.
Last month, Robert Flanders fired a dozen city employees and shut down the library and senior center. Professor Mazey says that may nudge the unions to the bargaining table, but if there's no deal soon, Central Falls will likely declare bankruptcy this summer. For NPR News, I'm Catherine Welch.
The summer season is in full swing, and that means many teenagers are trying to earn some extra cash. But the job market remains tough, especially for teens. As Illinois Public Radio's Mike Moen reports, Illinois is no exception.
It's a hot summer day in Chicago's far western suburbs. Workers at the Heritage Prairie Farm, which produces organic foods, are crouched in a sprawling field of crops. With the midday sun beating down on them, the crew members are feverishly pulling weeds.
Our business is a perfect business to employ teens during the summertime.
That's Bronwyn Weaver. She runs the farm with her husband. In addition to field work, teens are hired to help out with private events that are held on their property. Looking out on the field, Weaver acknowledges the disappointment she feels about not being able to hire as many teens as she would like to.
I'm a mother of two teenagers right now myself, so I know other moms who wish that they had jobs available to teach kids when to be on time, to teach kids good work ethics.
Weaver says recent increases in the minimum wage, along with Illinois' tax burden, prevent her from ramping up hiring during the summer.
I had so many really great kids email me, and I had to turn them away. So yes, it was very frustrating for me, and I'm proud of the jobs that we are able to provide. Right now, you see, there are two teenagers in our workforce, but, you know, there's 10 other jobs that I could have for 10 other kids.
17-year-old Andrew Byers is one of the teens working on the farm this summer. He says he was able to get the job because he's friends with Weaver's daughter. But his previous efforts to land a paying gig weren't as successful.
I looked at a lot of local places. Like, I almost got a job at Great Harvest last year, but then they decided they're not going to hire any teens.
Did they explain why?
No.
Okay.
There's probably just like more experienced people who are applying for the job.
Byers adds many of his friends are having a hard time finding work, and they're not alone. The Department of Labor puts the unemployment rate for teenagers at nearly 25% and more than 40% for African American teens. Illinois is one of many states that fall in line with the national average. Back on the recruitment side, the DeKalb Public Library saw what was coming when the recession tightened its grip. Management decided to stop hiring teens for shelving books and instead give the jobs to adults who were in need of work. Library Director Dee Coover.
We started getting piles of applications from people extraordinarily well qualified, and they've already been trained. They know how to show up for work on time. They know to work their whole shift. They know to not call in.
Coover says that doesn't mean they're giving up on helping teens get a taste of the real world. She says they still provide volunteer opportunities, which can help teens learn some basic job skills. Coover says they also realize the market will eventually come roaring back leaving them to give first-time job seekers a serious look for certain positions. Greg Rivera is with the Illinois Department of Employment Security. He says there are ways for teens to get around the problem.
What teens should do right now is grab their calendar and flip to December and make themselves a note to start looking for that summer job in March and in April, because that's really the best time to go ahead and find employment for the summer.
Rivera says teens can also improve their job prospects by placing a greater emphasis on how they prepare for the interview process. I'm Mike Moen.
Former First Lady Betty Ford's funeral was held yesterday in Palm Desert, California. Among the speakers were former First Lady Rosalynn Carter and the head of the Betty Ford Clinic. Ford will be laid to rest in Michigan tomorrow. NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates reports.
Three former First Ladies joined Michelle Obama in the front pew of St. Margaret's Episcopal Church for the funeral mass for Betty Ford. A frail Nancy Reagan walked in slowly, leaning on the arm of former President George W. Bush. Once seated, he conversed warmly with Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton. Michelle Obama sat next to her, chatting quietly with Rosalynn Carter, one of Mrs. Ford's closest friends, despite the fact that their husbands were once fierce political rivals.
Betty Ford was my friend, and I'm honored to be here today. I never imagined when we first met 40 years ago that we would develop such a close personal friendship.
Mrs. Carter was one of three eulogists Mrs. Ford requested years before. She spoke of how the two, despite belonging to opposite political parties, often worked together on mental health and women's rights issues.
She would round up the Republicans, I would round up the Democrats, and I think we were fairly effective most of the time.
Mrs. Ford was very effective in removing the stigma from two personal traumas, cancer and addiction.
Good afternoon. I'm Jeff. I'm an alcoholic.
Jeffrey Mason, her colleague at the Betty Ford Center, spoke about how Mrs. Ford's willingness to share her own struggles with prescription painkillers and alcohol encouraged him and thousands of others to continue that fight. Yesterday, he spoke directly to his friend, Betty.
And you said something that I've never forgotten. You said that you had discovered that you were allergic to alcohol. That, Betty, made it understandable.
NPR News analyst Cokie Roberts reminded those present that Betty Ford was the first First Lady to broaden that highly visible, unpaid position by insisting on retaining her personal authenticity.
Before her sudden ascension to First Lady, she said, "I'll move to the White House, do the best I can, and if they don't like it, they can kick me out, but they can't make me be somebody I'm not."
The former First Ladies assembled there.